Hello, everybody, and welcome to We Are Marvel, where we explore all of the corners of the Marvel Cinematic Multiverse. And we are also the official podcast of the We Are Marvel Facebook group. Please, for the love of all that is good and holy, go check them out today. And while you're there, head on over to the We Are Marvel pod page and give us a like and follow as well. We are your hosts plus guest. My name is Justin.
My name is Jeremy.
And joining us again today, we didn't even have to bribe him this time. He asked to come here, so the Clockwork Orange stuff is working. Dr. Joe from the Neutral Ground Podcast, welcome back, my good sir.
Always a pleasure, and I love this movie. Get to talk about a great film.
Well, that's what, because like I said, we had to coerce you with several means to get you into the X-Men's, but you asked to do this, so I was actually kind of interested and excited to hear why, out of all of the great movies like Howard the Duck, let's see, Daredevil, Hulk 2003, why you chose this one that you wanted to come on here for.
Oh, yeah. I've got a bunch of stuff to talk about. So whenever you're ready to let it fly, I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
Well, I don't have any other stupid meandering shit to say before getting into this. You, Jeremy?
No, let's get right into it.
All right. Grab your Icarus, everybody, and settle in for possibly, until Spider-Man Homecoming came out, the best Spider-Man movie ever made. Giddy up. All right, a brief synopsis for anybody who hasn't seen this, and if you really want to watch this and you don't own it, buy it. But also, it's on Disney Plus for free with your subscription. That's where I watched it, because Vudu is not always reliable. So Peter Parker is beset with troubles in his failing personal life as he battles a brilliant scientist named Dr. Otto Octavius, also known as Dr. Octopus. The tagline for this, which I thought was pretty great, is, "This summer, a man will face his destiny. A hero will be revealed."
Nice.
And yeah. He was. directed by Sam Raimi, screenplay by Alvin Sargent, based on Spider-Man by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, starring Tobey Maguire, Kirsten Dunst, James Franco, the amazing Alfred Molina, and the amazing Rosemary Harris, who does a great job in this one. And Donna Murphy, and I'm not sure who that was. I'm assuming it's the neighbor. But that's what was on Wikipedia, so what do you do? This released June 25th, 2004 in Mann Village Theater, and June 30th, 2004 in the U.S., budget of $200 million, and a box office of an impressive $789 million, which at the time was pretty big.
Donna Murphy is actually Doc Ock's wife.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, nice.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Fair enough. Well, that is all of the preamble I have. Let's get into general thoughts, and we will start with our good guest, Dr. Joe. Oh,
real quick, I do want to start with you.
Oh!
Did you point out that this came out 19 years ago today as of recording?
Well, really? Obviously I didn't because I didn't think about it. But wow, that is impressive.
It is. I know. I was like, what were the odds? I saw a post on Reddit, and I was like, what are the odds? Like, I'm seeing this post today, and we're recording today, and it's because it said it came out 19 years ago, and what are your thoughts? Today. So I will go back in there later and say, actually, here are my thoughts and two others, and share the link.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Well, who isn't?
Exactly.
That is cool. Yes, back to you. I didn't even think about that. Because, I mean, usually these things come out in May, but this one was a late June release.
Yeah, 19 years.
We didn't plan it, obviously. Let's just get that out of the way right now.
No.
But it is awesome how things work out.
Yes. So, yes, back to you, Dr. Joe. Let's get your thoughts, because you look eager to say them, and I'm excited for this.
Yeah, so my thoughts are, I remember sitting in the movie theater watching this and leaving and absolutely loving it. And you know what? For me, it was even better rewatching it again. I actually genuinely love this movie. Yeah, that you could nitpick certain things about it, but you can't beat certain themes that are discussed in this film that have spoke to me back then and speak to me even more now. So I'll just jump into one right off the bat, which is this idea of, so I'm a movie nerd, and I'm going to enter into this conversation through another film. I love the Rocky films, you know, even Rocky V, which, you know, most people hate, but I like it. It's fine. But what I really love about those films is how it progresses in terms of the ego of the male. So when it's Rocky I, he's just good enough, not to win, but to be successful to be in the fight. It's only after, in Rocky II, when he's in the hospital with Adrian, and Adrian pulls him close to him and says, I want you to do one thing for me. Win. And that's what allows Rocky to go into that next level to be able to be greater than what he was. This film, Spider-Man 2 for me, played into that idea as well. He grows stronger. He becomes something greater because he now loves something way more than he could love himself. And I love the way that it doesn't shy away from the idea of there's power in loving someone. There really is true power, because I tend to believe that, actually. And it doesn't have to be necessarily even romantic. It just has to be, there's got to be something greater than you, something that you love more than you. And it's only when you love something more than you that you can truly unlock, I think, your fullest kind of potential in life, because loving yourself will only get so far. And I absolutely just loved, even back then when I was, you know, an aspiring reader of literature and sitting there and going, oh yes, that's a lovely theme. You know, today, 19 years later, I'm still sitting there going, oh, this is phenomenal. And what a great message too, in days like today, which something we might talk about. Days like today, when Aunt May's speech, when Henry is there and talking about, we need heroes. Well, look, what's the, to me, I mean, I've talked about this both at conferences, professional conferences. I got laughed at for talking about it actually at a conference. But I made the argument, or one of the arguments, was that the reason why the MCU, specifically those first three phases, were so successful is because they took the hero seriously. Yeah, there was fun. But you know what? When people and grown men are crying in a movie theater because a man in a funny outfit is picking up a hammer, that means something. You've given somebody hope. And that's what the MCU did so well, particularly in those first three phases, is build up that idea of hope. And in this film, this was the one for me that took that seriously as well. That said, you know what? This isn't a joke. It's not just some people running around in funny costumes. You need heroes in life because we need standards to look against and say, you know what? I could be that. Or at the very least, I could fight to be that. And I felt like today, rewatching the film and hearing Aunt May talk that way, it felt to me like she was talking to us today, right in this moment even. Hmm. But what do you think?
I think it's not going to get much better than that this episode. Good night, everybody.
Yeah. We'll just loop that three times.
Did I mention I love this film?
Call it good. No, yeah. I would... I mean, I didn't really think about it while watching it, but I did have that kind of moment during Aunt May's speech when it was coming up, and I was like, oh yeah, this, and it was like, wow, this really is that. And what got me was the train sequence, which is great anyway, and we'll go into that big time later, but when he's saving the train, I was like, this is his Superman stopping the helicopter. Like, this is his big superhero moment that honestly I don't know if any of the other Spider-Man movies have, where it is that inspirational, holy crap, like this is the hero we all want and need to be. And you have to think about the time frame in which it came out. I mean, the first one came out less than a year after 9/11. This was 2 years after that. I mean, there's just this yearning around the country and the world, really, for heroes. And Spider-Man comes out and says, here I am. And it does it, like you were talking about, it does it in such an earnest way where it's not just a doofy guy in red and blue tights. It's this hero. And something as what could be as dopey as a guy with four robot arms is fantastic. And they put the time and energy into making it look amazing. And we'll get into that later, too. But, yeah, I mean, I've always loved this movie. It truly is one of the early comic book films that, like we've talked about with the X-Men's, where it's a film. It's like, Hulk is a movie. Daredevil, as much as I enjoy it and champion it, it's just a movie. Spider-Man 2 is a film. Like, this takes the genre and takes it seriously and says, this can do something. We're not quite at The Dark Knight yet, or Iron Man 1, but we're getting close.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say both well said. I mean, you covered all the main points. What I'll talk about is I kind of forgot how much of a horror type movie this was. Because I watched it with my 8-year-old, and like I was worried. I was like, oh boy, they're showing some stuff here that I'm kind of concerned. Like I checked on it a couple times, and when it was done, I was like, that was a lot, huh? And she's like, yeah. like what are you showing me here? Because I totally forgot how much. I mean, it makes sense, you know, because it's Sam Raimi, but I forgot about this movie and how much of just the screaming, the horror elements, and the just using shadows. And I mean, he did a great job, phenomenal job of shooting this. And yeah, it was great. And like you guys said, I enjoyed it so much more watching it again. I don't know if maybe just because we're older, we've aged more, we know more, or we just know what's happening and we're excited for it. But it was so much better watching it again now versus back then. I'm sure I had a great time back then, but it was a different great time now. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I'm really liking us going back and watching these movies because it brings a new appreciation to some of these. I won't say all of these. So
Howard the Duck.
And this is definitely one.
Yeah. That Doc Ock scene when he's face down in the hospital and they're trying to remove the arms, I did not remember that being as horrific as it was at all. Yeah. I was like, this is genuinely creepy how they're moving and the horror of the screams and everything. I did not remember that at all.
I know.
Yeah, I remember back when, before this came out, a clip of it leaked online and the video was kind of crappy, so I couldn't really see much, but I heard like the screaming and like bits of the arms and the doctors running around, and it's like, Jesus, this is going to be awesome. And it's, and we'll get into it when we get into the movie, but it's like the best, one of my favorite scenes in a comic book movie, because I'm a big horror guy in general, but like, it was so fucking cool.
Yeah, it's great.
All right, well, let's just get into this, because we've already talked about most of the movie already. let's see. I took a crap ton of notes that we certainly don't have to get into all of, but I did love hearing the classic score well up again in the beginning, and then you see the amazing artwork by Alex Ross, which if you don't know his work, look at the opening of this. He does basically life-like renderings of superheroes using actual people as his models and paints it, and it's incredible.
Yeah, it was great.
It's a beautiful opening.
And if you guys want to elaborate on anything I spout out here, let me know. The pizza boy thing was pretty funny. There's some very dated jokes in this that don't always land. But I do like, in classic Peter Parker fashion, he can't hold down a job. He's trying to do five things at once. We later see Dylan Baker, who I love, as Kurt Connors. Unfortunately, he never gets to be Lizard, which makes me sad. But you see him juggling his life and failing at it in every possible way.
Yeah, and I think that's even, that's another one of those themes that spoke to me a lot watching it again, too, is this idea of, so let's update it for a second, right? So we are full-blown on internet all the time at this point, right? Access to everyone now is 24/7. My students laugh at me when I tell them that I grew up in a time when the internet was something you turned on. And then you turned off. Like, in other words, it's not, it was as if psychologically.
It made a horrible screeching sound to get there.
It was like psychologically, you disconnected from it. Yeah. Even though it was still there, you shut it off.
Yeah. It was like turning on and off a TV.
Exactly. And so, thinking about this film and thinking about how much he's trying to accomplish, how many people today, all of us, probably even as well, how many of us feel like we're being tugged at all the time and trying to think about, okay, if I give everyone 24/7 access to my life, how much time do I have just for me? And it sounds selfish, right? But it's not really a selfish question. It's a question about, when do I get to work on me and to be me and to share myself with others, right? And that's something that Parker is trying to figure out. How much of me is there when I have to give 24/7 access to the world, Spider-Man? And so it even made me think of that, and not to jump the gun maybe too much, but connects with this. You mentioned the train scene, and my mind immediately went to, no cell phones. Everybody is just staring at him.
No one's doing a selfie pic with Spider-Man collapsed on the ground going, hey, Spider-Man.
Exactly. And I thought to myself, you know what? The world we live in today enhances the beauty of that scene more than when I watched it originally. Because I could picture trying to do that scene today in a film and not having anyone take out their cell phones, and you think to yourself, you know what? I believe them. I believe it. Nobody took out their cell phones. They want to help him. They want to respect him. But it was almost weird to see that and not see everybody with their cell phones out in some sense. Well,
that just made me think of that scene in Shang-Chi when he's fighting the guys on the train, and the dude who's in one of the Spider-Man movies takes out his phone. He's like, I know karate, but I'm told I'm not supposed to do this anymore. You know, I tried to drive a bus once, and I got yelled at. Like, even in that high-octane fight scene, there's some dickhead with a phone filming it. Like,
Always. And if you wanted to be cynical, right, you would say, well, you know, if that happens, somebody would take their phone out. But that's not the point. The point is something that Marvel, I think, does well is to beat back cynicism and try to say, no, we can push aside selfish cynicism. We can. And I do believe that you could write that scene today and it would mean more that nobody took out their cell phone, that they simply said, you know what, let's make a social pact with each other. This stays with us, and that's it.
Oh, I just had an image of a scene of, like, just, you know, some kid starting to, and someone puts their hand down and goes, no.
Nope. Yeah, put how beautiful down. Would that be, like, right?
It gives me shivers just thinking about it. That'd be cool.
Yeah, no, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, with the same, using, I mean, you can use the same dialogue, the, you know, your secret's safe with us, and yeah, that would, it, I think you're right, it would mean more now than it probably did then, yeah. Hmm. Well, good call. I didn't even think about the no cell phones thing, but yeah. Because I did notice the payphone later, and I wanted to ask my daughter. I was like, I just asked her, do you even know what that is? Yeah, I didn't, though.
The part in his hand looks kind of familiar, but the rest of it, it's just a weird box. Is that an outhouse? In New York? Yes.
Yeah. And one more thing before we get too far is, I think they did a great job of having Toby look exhausted, because he did. You could see it all over his face. I don't know if they had him stay awake all night or something, or just immediately woke him up from a nap and had him do the scene. But
okay, Spider-Man.
You could, right? But you could just tell in his face, his eyes are just puffy and red, and he just looked exhausted. And of course, seeing him later, and he looks a lot more rested and stuff. And I'm, of course, it was conscience, but they did a great job of just showing that those little things. Because you don't have to do that. You could just say it, and that's enough usually. But yeah. to show it the way they did, I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about something even more serious here, and it's how much Harry likes to ruin every party he goes to.
Not fun. Yeah. Not fun to invite. No.
No, he is a downer.
We're just trying to have some birthday cake. We're at this astronomy thing. We're just trying to, like, this astronaut just got engaged. Like, some people hanging out in your apartment. Just be chill.
I will say this. This is the nitpicky part of me. When Franco was trying to be intense and there were other actors in the room, there were parts of me sometimes where I thought, take it down a little fella. Just a click. Take it down. You know?
See, there were some Melina parts where I was like, this is getting a little caricature-y, but it's Melina, so it's okay. At least it's better than Franco's performance in Spider-Man 3.
Oof.
I know that face.
Yeah, Spider-Man 3.
We'll get there.
I'm going to hear that so much, that episode. I don't know if I'm really looking forward to it or not.
As soon as you pop up on the screen, I know that face. I can't wait.
I'm going to be laughing when it happens, and my wife and daughter are going to be so confused. Great.
Usually he's so sad when he's recording, but he can't stop laughing. Well, let's talk about Alfred Molina as Doc Ock, because, there are some parts that are hammy and some dialogue that's a little cringy, but for the most part, he's incredible. And I remember when he was cast, thinking, that guy's going to be great, even only knowing him from, like, Indiana Jones and Not Without My Daughter, which is also a great movie.
I loved him. I thought he was phenomenal, and, the way he delivers that final line of, I will not die a monster. Oh, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, you live for a line like that to go out on in a film. That's just phenomenal. And the love that he shows, his performance stayed the same for me. In other words, I remember loving it the first time and I loved it just as much this time. I didn't see much movement between then and now, but the love that he has for his wife early on, still very much just sets it up so wonderfully, that kind of rise. And something else that I noticed too, when they talk about AI in this film, just that one throwaway kind of line about the arms, and they're like, it's AI. How are you going to stop AI? And here we are again, updated, right? Here we are in 2023. And back then, there was this kind of a comic booky way of looking at AI, right? Like, it's a thing and it's going to harm you potentially and this. And today we nuance it so much, we don't have as much of a line from which to say, like, stop the AI. Although there are certainly conversations that can happen around that about probably why maybe we should at least slow it down a little bit here. Oh,
there's a whole Marvel movie about it, really.
But I love
somewhere
the
Ultron's
idea.
Doing the Doctor Evil.
Oh, Ultron, that's one of those. I won't get sidetracked, but that has grown on me exponentially, that film, quite honestly. It really has. So I just thought it was fascinating to look at AI in such a clear way at that time, to say, well, we don't want that attaching itself to human beings. And now we've got these discussions of, well, how far away are we from completely merging with AI in some meaningful way? And that's when I say I'm out. I'll be glad. Sure. It's probably be when I'm dead, and I'm okay with that. Don't bring me back. I'm out.
So you don't want to pull a Zola and be part computer?
No, I'm done. I'm out. Just pull the plug.
I mean, if I could still watch movies, I think I'd be okay with it. I'd miss, like, eating food, because that's good, but, We'll see what Marvel's doing by then. I will, since we're talking about the arms already, I do love what they did with the arms. They look incredible.
Yes.
This sort of, I always kind of have a relation to their actions like the velociraptors from Jurassic Park.
Yep.
Like the way they move around and snake around and like hiss at each other. Like that could have been so dumb, but they're menacing.
They are
like,
phenomenal.
They're actually kind of frightening, especially in the hospital scene. But like even I've always loved the scene when he goes to the pier for the first time and he's all downtrodden and it's like, you know, my wife is dead, my machine is dead, and I should be at the bottom of the river with these pieces of shit. Like it's I know I'm kind of making light of it, but like it's such a great scene. It's so emotional and his devastation, and he's totally at rock bottom, and then you see them talking to him and he says there's something talking to me, and then he makes that turn. It's why when I saw No Way Home and they turn off the arms communicating with him in Happy's apartment and he said I can't hear the voices, like I get choked up because it's 20 years later me remembering these arms basically trying to ruin this guy's life, and the fact that he was able to shut it off, like that's such an emotional moment for people like us who grew up with this movie.
Yeah, no, you're right. It was a great callback, because it was them controlling him and talking to him and almost coaxing him into it, and yeah, it was cool how they did it. I liked it. Now I do got a question that my daughter asked me, and I just kind of lied to her to help, you know, kind of keep the curtains down, if you will. She asked, now I'm sure there was a line, another throwaway line, but why didn't the arms get sucked in? Because they were made of metal, but it must have been
a different
kind of metal?
Yeah.
There was a throwaway line.
There is a throwaway line.
Yes.
I don't remember what it was, but yeah,
they're
it's
non-magnetic.
A different kind of metal.
Yes, Melina says they resist. It's when he starts going over that they can handle more than the heat of the sun, and they're not magnetic. He adds that in to make sure you know why he's not getting pulled in.
Yeah, because she asked. She's like, why aren't his arms getting pulled in?
That's a good
question,
I
didn't remember the line. Yeah, so I just said, I was like, oh, yeah, they're made out of special metal, so they don't get pulled in. I was right, but it was by accident. I just wanted to say, you know, let's not get stuck on this. It's a great question. I'm not sure, but I will say so that we can all move forward. Yeah. Okay, there was a line. I'm glad I got that clear, and I was right.
So before we go on with more Doc Ock stuff, because there's plenty more, I have a question that is for you guys. And I mean, it's more or less kind of been confirmed by Sam Raimi and storyboards for Spider-Man 4. But there is a fan theory that Bruce Campbell is Quentin Beck purposefully fucking with Spider-Man in all three movies. Because in the first one, he's the ref. In this one, he's the guy at the theater who won't let him in. And in the third one, he's a waiter who screws with him some more.
Right.
There are storyboards that show if Raimi's Spider-Man 4 had happened, his cameo would have been as Mysterio in an opening scene of him being foiled.
Wow.
Wow.
I would have loved that. Because, I mean, because you're right. He is in each movie, and he is a different character, and he is just messing with Spider-Man every time. And especially in this one, it was just the littlest things. It was the stopping him and, oh, your shoe's untied. And, mm-hmm. oh, you should fix your tie. All just to say, yeah, I'm not letting you in. I'm just wasting your time even more. I would have loved that so much. It'd be great.
Yeah, that would work out really well. I forgot that he was in the other ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the announcer in the wrestling arena. And then I haven't watched Spider-Man 3 on purpose in so long, but... If I remember right, he's the waiter when Peter's trying to maybe ask MJ to marry him, and he kind of fucks with him some more there.
Okay. And then he's Papa Pizza in No Way Home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pizza Papa. Get it right.
Pizza Papa.
Or don't get it at all.
Sorry.
And there's another Sam Raimi-ism in that yellow car. I think it's one that Doc Ock flips or something. Is in every single Raimi movie. He has this yellow car. It's in Evil Dead. It's in Multiverse of Madness. It's in all the Spider-Mans that he has in every single movie. And it's his actual personal car.
Cool.
Yeah.
I bet he did it the first time just to get it written off. And then he's like, I'm just going to throw it in. Why not?
That's smart. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about how smart it is to have something that is the power of the sun in a warehouse in downtown New York. Because I can only see that going well.
Yeah.
He was very confident. Like, we all knew it was a bad idea, and we had Peter to point out, hey, isn't this a bad idea? But he was still just so confident. It's impossible. I made a mistake, and this and that. But then it's such a simple thing that is the problem. It's like, how do you not see that coming? But, of course, we have to have it happen in the movie. But, yeah, it's a terrible idea.
I love the nuance. The nuance of it, though, it, you know, for me, Infinity War Thanos was so interesting because of that idea of the benevolent dictator. In other words, I'm going to do what I'm about to do out of goodness, you know? And I find that, of course, interesting on a grand scale. But on that smaller scale, it was nice to see this idea of the individual who makes the mistake out of benevolence. Because that's an understandable kind of villain as well. It's not that you completely forgive, you know, what he does, but you never quite throw him away. It's why you're so happy when he says, I won't die as a monster. And something, let me ask you guys this, if you had this feeling. So the MCU has scaled quite a bit throughout, from beginning to where we are now even. And so many times, so many things seem to be world-ending. You know? World-ending all the time. Big. And there was something that was just so beautifully refreshing about the localness of this. It was, I'm going to take out half the city. Mm-hmm. And potentially things could probably be worse. But there was something beautiful about the ability to just control this in an area, a beautifully localized story. Did that hit any of you in that way at all?
I'll let Jeremy go first.
I did notice it, that it wasn't a big, like, hey, you can destroy the world with this, or you can, the country, or anything. It was, you can destroy half the city. And I thought that was different than, like you said, than normal. It's not a entire world problem that only I can save. It was just my little neighborhood can get destroyed. So I did notice it for sure, but for me, unfortunately, that's probably as far as it went. I just noticed it. It was different.
Yeah, I didn't notice it as much in this. That was one of the things that I loved so much about Homecoming when I first saw it. Because, you know, even with this one, it's like, well, I have this big grand machine that's going to destroy, the whole city. But Homecoming, it was just this jerk in a vulture suit stealing from my friend. And no one will listen to me, so I have to stop him because only I can. But I did notice this one gave me a lot of Superman the movie vibes and classic comic book vibes, where he's going to rob the bank to fix his machine, and he's got his lair on the bay and whatever the hell. And like it's so classic comic book that I loved it for that. I didn't think of it in terms of necessarily small scale, but it was just every classic comic book trope kind of done with a wink, but also done well, to where it's like, yeah, that's what you'd do. He'd rob the bank, and Joel McHale's a dickhead and trying to steal the coin and shit, which is funny.
Yeah. I did notice that too. So many coins in that bank vault. you just wouldn't see that these days. You know, first of all, you'd see them in rolls, but you wouldn't even see that many coins anyways.
And it is. It's the classic bank robber scene in any, you know, hero movie, with a guy with a bunch of bags full of gold coins. Like I didn't really necessarily think of it in terms of small scale, but it is classic, like, cops and robbers, which is what comics used to be.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the how controlled it was. That you didn't have to think about higher stakes than what was on the screen. Whereas there's something wonderful about the larger scale model as well, right? Because then your brain is always interconnecting the phases in the films and outside of the phases as well. But it was almost calming and enjoyable to get a kind of refresh of a self-contained kind of film where it was just kind of like, this is it. This is the villain. And when that villain is stopped, for the most part, things are fine. Things are okay.
Yeah. Well, I think this shows what a good self-contained comic book trilogy can be until you get to the fumbles of Spider-Man 3. Like, when you watch the MCU, everything is connected, and you have to watch the next thing and the previous thing to get this thing. Even more so now, to the point where it's almost detracting people. And then you've also seen the DCU trying to do that and failing, and it gets even more frustrating. And so it is kind of refreshing in an era where this is a franchise, but it's not a mega franchise with spinoffs and interconnected this and whatevers. It's like a Star Wars where you have a beginning, middle, and end-ish to a story. It is kind of nice.
Yeah.
And it's not fumbled like a Daredevil or Hulk or a Fantastic Four or a everything else, Ghost Rider.
Yes.
Which is coming.
Oh, good luck with
sooner
that.
Sooner than we like.
Is it really? Oh, no. Okay.
That's how I
focus on this. Focus on this.
I will say, it's something that didn't bother me when I first saw it. I was just happy to see the character. But watching it today, John Jameson is possibly the most underused and unnecessary character in a movie. He seems like his only skill is just looking good in a uniform. And yet Mary Jane is willing to marry him because he's there. And Peter isn't.
Yeah, he was an astronaut, right? They did say that, and he just got back. Yeah. So he got that going for him.
I'm a handsome astronaut.
When I was 12, it was like, oh, hey, that's a cool nod to the comics. I know that. But in this, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. He's an astronaut. I don't think he does anything but that. He's attractive, yes. And he's been there. And I guess for Mary Jane, she's getting that attention that she wants from a male. You know, she wants it from Peter, but he's not doing it. And so he is. But I mean, yeah, it's kind of pointless. It didn't need to be John James. It could have been any other attractive male.
It just occurred to me, but if they hadn't done the Harry MJ thing in the first one, this would have been a good one to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Just to be, especially with Harry going down his cuckoo party crasher phase, like, that actually would have been really interesting.
Yeah, I felt bad for him in the kissing check scene.
That was rough. Yes.
But it was like, funny though when he was like, "I'm on the moon. Are you with me?" And she gives the look of nope.
She's like,
not even close. No,
she doesn't even answer him. And I'm thinking, dude, you need to have a conversation.
Maybe stay on the moon.
Yeah, maybe go back.
I did feel bad for the guy though. Like he didn't do anything to deserve it. He wasn't like, oh, she finally found out who you really are and she left you. It's just he was just trying his best.
And I had a hard time kind of rooting for Peter this time because he's just kind of a wad a lot of times. And we get the ghost Uncle Ben scene where he shits on him kind of again, like he did in the first movie. And it's just like, dude, stop. Like you're Spider-Man. You can't. I think it's the right thing, and it became kind of the trope of the second movie to be like the hero being like, I don't want to do this. This fucking sucks. Yeah. To eventually realizing they have to. Like, I get it. Mm-hmm. And you also, it's the classic Spider-Man, I think it's number 50 issue of Spider-Man No More. Like, they say it multiple times, even in the newspaper. Before anyone else knows, the newspaper knows. And they recreate that iconic panel of the suit draped over the garbage can. So it's great and I get it, but there were points in this where I was just like, just get your shit together a little bit. Like, you don't have to be in a relationship with Mary Jane to not be a jerk to her all the time. You don't have to sacrifice, you know, being a hero to just be a little bit more, you know, like to have a job. It's just, it's interesting. Like, I get, it's classic Spider-Man, but for some reason watching it today, maybe I was just angsty. It was just like, I just get it together a little bit more. Because we've seen Tom Holland do it. And so it just makes it seem like it is doable. He has more tech, obviously, and better friends, but you know, they're not crashing as many parties, but, you know.
Ned is trying to crash parties.
I mean, it was kind of... It's kind of odd, you know, when he's going through that whole, you know, section of like, no, I'm not going to participate anymore in saving. And that guy's getting beaten up in the alley.
Yeah, that's one of my notes.
You know, Spider-Man doesn't have to go over there, but maybe Peter Parker might, like, I don't know, tell somebody.
Call the cops?
He's just like,
no. It's New York. There's cops everywhere. Just
And then when they...
Yeah, at least to yell.
Okay, when... this guy's getting beat up over here. I had to go deliver
pizza, though. Spider-Man's not going. It's like, okay, that's fine, you know? And then they double down with the firefighters after he saves the little girl, and they're like, yeah, there's a dead guy up there. You're like, oh, God.
You missed that one, didn't you, Chief? I
know. Yeah. Spidey senses are low.
Yeah, it was a half second of, hey, good job, buddy. Yeah, he didn't get them all, though, so I don't know what he was doing. Okay,
those firefighters are the real heroes.
Technically, the little girl kind of saved him somehow, too.
She lifts up Spider-Man.
I think she has the powers.
Yeah. And the parents are on the outside. They're just kind of standing there like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was so weird.
I thought you grabbed her.
Yeah, they're just watching it like, there she goes, up in flames.
There's someone in the building. Our daughter. Isn't she special? Yeah. She's in there.
She was. Like,
so we're waiting for Spider-Man.
So weird. Well, I mean, it's... They do it in the first movie, which I know this is supposed to be kind of a callback to, but the first one's worse because it's a baby. And this mother, like, leaves her baby in this inferno, and it's like, wouldn't that be, I don't know, the second or third thing you grab, at least, before you leave?
Yeah.
If like, not first, yes. Yeah. It's top three.
Yeah, exactly. Like, your iPod Nano, and then,
your phone, the baby. You know. Maybe your couple of your favorite movies that are lumped together on the shelf, and then you grab the kid.
Then the kid, yeah.
And this couple had both of them. Like, what all were they getting or doing where they couldn't be like, hey, where's our kid? I thought she was at the sitters. Uh-oh.
Is she in that closet? I told you to lock it.
Gosh, she loves to hide in there. This will be the last time she does that.
That's it.
I also thought that Peter should focus more on the cute blonde girl who gives him free chocolate cake than MJ, who's kind of horrible to him all the time.
Yeah, I made that up in my head. I thought I remembered there being a kind of quick failed relationship between those two. And I realized, you know, after he's eating the cake, I thought, oh, this is where I think they have a little thing. And then never happened. And I realized, oh my God, I made that up completely in my head.
Because it should have been there.
Yeah, it should have been there.
Or at least not Peter. Like, and I mean, guys are stupid. We all know this. So, I mean, the idea that this girl was pining after him and he's just like, hey, cool cake.
Hey.
That would happen.
I did get some cake out of it.
I think she likes me, but I don't know. Her dad sucks, so I'm...
It's your typical guy story, getting cake.
And eating it, too.
I know.
Oh, man.
So, we already kind of talked about May's inspirational speech, which was very good. If anyone has anything else on that, otherwise we're going to get to Doc Ock throwing a car at a building.
Sounds good.
Well, actually, there was something I didn't want to say about Ben's ghost kind of scene. For me, it was strange. I will say that, but it the way I kind of saw it once I watched the rest of the movie, it was that he was kind of trying to be Spider-Man and the best Spider-Man that could be because of Ben. And he was trying to do it for mm-hmm. Ben. And so when he finally, and when he told him no and he came back and he kind of was Spider-Man for himself, is I think, well, I saw that as that's what it was. Is he's now doing it for himself. He doesn't have that pressure of Uncle Ben having to live up to what Uncle Ben thinks he should be. So, I mean, I did like that, but I do agree it was kind of a weird way to do it.
I do like that it was a recreation of being in the car and they're wearing the same clothes and all that stuff. Like, I did think it was good, but I think it was what was more effective was May's speech about there being a hero in all of us and there's something inside of us that just makes us want to do good and do the right thing. And I think it could have been executed better to show, especially with the mugging scene, is just rough. Like, there's no excuse, but there's something that's like, I think they could have portrayed better him wanting to do those things, but deciding not to. It was more like a relief of like, well, fuck those guys. All this, these cop cars are going down the road. Don't have to deal with that shit anymore. Like, it felt more like that to me than like, I want to, but I just can't. And I think part of it is also because his life still sucked. Like, he gave up being Spider-Man, but his little montage of like, yeah, you're doing better in school, but that's about it. Like, you don't really have a job. You don't have MJ or any real life. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Your friend still sucks.
Your friend's
still ruining parties.
I didn't think about it until just now. It's an interesting parallel, right? In terms of, so Ben is the father figure here, right? And he's trying to put that father voice to rest and to try to say, I can't be. It's funny because Ben's voice is not about success or failure, right? Like, Peter always knows that he had the love of Uncle Ben, always. He never had to question that. So it was more about success in terms of you have a gift and you should be giving that, using that gift for the world. Harry, the Harry relationship with his father, he's never able to put that to rest, to have that kind of conversation until the very end when the conversation actually happens, like in his head. And now, because he knows that he can never get the love of his father, he spends the film trying to succeed him, trying to be better than him in everything. And then he realizes he can't even be that. And so all that's left to do is to kind of merge the two into one, to kind of become symbiotic with each other. Peter's breaking with Uncle Ben in that moment is fascinating in the sense that he realizes, I have to give up Uncle Ben. I have to give up that love that I've always had to fall back on. And that's a crushing moment to have to do that, right? And even in what's wrong with me? I can't remember the actor's name.
Which one?
Uncle Ben. That's
Cliff Robertson.
Yes. His face, the way he pulls back in that kind of disappointment mirrors Aunt May's face, of course. Her reaction, too, when Peter tells her, this is what I did. That disappointment. And yet what happens when Peter comes back during the leaving scene? She says, look, let's not even talk about it. You have my love always, basically, to fall back on. And so I was trying to work through, I don't know if I said it well, but when I was watching it, I was trying to work through this parallel of father-son figures and the idea of knowing you have a love underneath that relationship and how that makes you view the world versus when you don't have it. And then you reach the end of the film with Harry, you know, you're never going to get it. And you can't even go past what your father was. That part stood out to me more because I'm older today than I was back then. And so, like I said, I'm not sure anything really comes out of that, but I just, something to think about. I just thought it was fascinating.
Well, I think it's what makes it tough, because I think Spider-Man 3 really fumbled the pass that was so gently given to them.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I remember at the end of Spider-Man 1 when you have Harry spouting off about wanting revenge on Spider-Man, and then even the trailers for this one, seeing that Harry was going to have Spider-Man on his couch all bound up and about to reveal us. Like, it's such a great progression to then get to 3 where it's a blink and you miss it, nothing at the beginning of the next movie. It's like they really missed a turn in forcing Raimi to use Venom. Mm-hmm. But even that, like, he could have done it better. Because to me, Venom is the darkness of Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. Well, why was that darkness not directed at Harry? Except for when he beat the shit out of him in that alley and put him in that, I know that face coma. Like, they could have been like, okay, you see what would have happened if Spider-Man had gone down the same path that Harry was going down. And then they clash at the end and, you know, have to come together or whatever. Like, I feel like it could have been done so much better. But I do love what they did with Harry in this one, except for his party crashing days, that that reveal at the end when he sees the Goblin Cave, and he's just like, this is what I'm meant to do. It's fantastic. Like, it's a pre-MCU stinger scene that is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like this is the legacy that I was supposed to take over, not being in charge of Oscorp, but this, yeah. Hmm.
So Doc Ock throws a car at a building at what he assumes is just a normal, nerdy guy and his girlfriend. What did he think was going to happen?
I didn't think it at that point, but I did think it when he threw him against the wall.
Yeah.
And half of the wall came crashing down. Like, how do you expect him to relay this message to Spider-Man if you just killed him? Because a normal human would be dead.
Yeah.
Well, that always bothered me is they show that camera angle outside of the cafe, and Doc Ock's not there, but you see the thumping. Where was he? Where did he throw this car from that he was able to get it through this window and then fuck off to where he's not right there? And then he just shows up again, pounding on the pavement at getting into the cafe. Like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, my mind went into the brick wall also. When the brick wall, when his body hits the brick wall and it's crumbling, that's when I think I'm starting to think to myself, well, that's not normal. Maybe maybe this guy's something else here.
Oh, and you should have died. Are you Spider-Man?
Hey, how is Doc Ock not double taking? Like, wait a minute.
He's a fusion scientist, but he doesn't understand bone density. Yes. Well,
he also doesn't understand you shouldn't light suns in the middle of downtown New York. So, I mean, what do you do? He's not a great scientist.
Nah, he's not.
He was bottom of the class with Connors and Osborne. Let's see. So I guess we should talk about the train fight, because that's pretty much next, and it's amazing. Everything about that, like, just watching the Doc Ock action scenes and just seeing those incredible arms do their Doc Ockness was so great. Like, that's the stuff that transported me back to 2004, seeing it in theaters, going, oh my god, it's Doc Ock.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. It looked amazing. It just, like you said, the arms looked great. Like, they looked real in a lot of scenes. I can't think of many where I was like, oh yeah, there's the CGI. Most of the time, they looked real. Mm-hmm. And it looked great. And the train, it's just, it is so heroic feeling. Like, he is stopping a train. It doesn't sound that great, but the way he does it and the strength that he goes through and how much pain he's going through. Yeah, it was great. The only part of it I didn't like that I kind of forgot was the, like, sarcastic line that the train conductor gives him. You got any other bright ideas?
Any more bright ideas? Yeah, that old guy was a dick. Yeah, like, watch out!
It's like, yeah, thanks. No, I don't. See ya.
That didn't work. Well, fuck off, guys. Bye.
I just thought it was weird.
I got to go save my girlfriend, so peace.
I think it would have been better if it was a better line of you know, can you? Is there anything else you can do? Can you help us?
Yeah.
You know, something better, but... It's nitpicking. It's a little thing.
Yeah.
Overall, movie's great.
Speaking of great lines, I hope you put this in the episode somewhere of the lady early on in the movie when he's stopping the robbers, and she goes, "It's a web. Go, Spidey, go!" Ugh. So, ugh. Scenes like that make me glad we're in now times and not early 2000s comic book movie times, because...
But you know what? Yeesh. You know what's fascinating too about this film? It's like, yeah, if you stopped and you were forcing yourself to be consciously aware of like the CGI, of course you could see it in every, you know, every scene. But maybe the highest compliment you can even say about films today that use a lot of CGI is, as long as you're never taken out of the moment because of the CGI, then I think they've done a good job. And I was never taken out of this film because of the CGI. And there was something about the fluidity and the perfect pacing of the arms and the way Spider-Man moved that was incredibly well done. And I'll give you the fail example. I love The Thing, John Carpenter's. I even love the original Thing. When The Thing 2 came out, I mean, I was really disappointed, but mostly because I was disappointed at how it moved in the CGI. And maybe Alien 3 is another example of something that moves either so quickly that you can't enjoy what it's trying to do. It doesn't match the pacing of the film. I thought that the CGI pacing, the way the arms moved, the way Spider-Man moved around the scene, I thought that that was beautiful, beautifully done. Nothing too quick. Everything was done just perfectly. And that made me want to look at other films and take a look at the pacing and see if that is something that I don't know, others should kind of copy in some way.
For sure. I mean, there's some scenes where they show a CG Molina, and it's very obviously a CG Molina, but there's other scenes that are so incredible looking, like when they're falling down the building and you see each tentacle trying to grasp and do stuff, and the one that finally goes and gets to the wall, which makes them stop. Like, it looks amazing. Yeah. Like, it looked good today.
I agree.
That kind of arm. Like, I don't think the arms do anything that cool in No Way Home, except for maybe on the bridge.
Yeah.
And it was light, too. The big thing today to save money, of course, is to darken all of your CGI scenes so that you can hide in the shadows. And they did that in the
early days of CG, too.
This is a hugely...
Because it looks so shitty.
Yeah, it's a huge, bright film. I mean, this film even had, like...
It's practically yellow.
I was going to say, I was even looking at the lighting, just from the lighting perspective, how they had hot spots on people that were, like, really, you know, bright white. And but there's something courageous about that, right? Because then you can't hide at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a good point.
So Doc Ock captures Spider-Man, of course, albeit, you know, after the city people tried to step in for him and brings him to Harry, who ruins what could have been, I think, a very nice little party. We had, you know, it's just Harry and Doc Ock and Spider-Man. There were drinks, very cozy, and Harry just fucking ruined it again.
It's what he does.
It is. It's just, he's the worst. But I do love that scene. I do, like, as much as I go back and forth on Franco, and he's certainly fallen out of favor as of late, no comment on that.
Mm-hmm.
He does a decent job, like, when he finds out that he is Peter. And he kind of has that aback moment and collapses on the couch and holy shit. And I kind of was wishing they'd kept going with that, but we had like 20 minutes left of the movie and he still had to save Mary Jane. But it was still a pretty good scene for a tee-up of what, you know, Spider-Man 3 is.
Yeah. And give Tobey Maguire credit in that scene too, the way he delivers that line with that interestingly... seemingly awkward hesitation, but it works really well when he says, "This is bigger than me and you."
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, wow. Yeah. He's trying to move his friend. Hey, we can deal with this later, man.
It was a nice way of doing it because, I mean, again, from even Spider-Man 1, it's like, you need to see these two come to blows, because that's what this trilogy is supposed to be about. And the fact that Peter in that moment's like, listen, I know we have to deal with this, because you have some issues. We haven't had a nice party since this happened. It's just been rough. But I can't right now. And that Harry, he's a piece of shit, but he's also like, oh, he has MJ. I didn't know that. Like, he's just said that he wanted his stupid tritium. That's the most rare thing on Earth. But Harry got it twice. And even bigger the second time, which is quite impressive.
And on short notice. Like,
yeah.
It was real quick.
And he's like, I'm ruined. I'm like, sell the tritium.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You'll be fine
if it's as rare as you say.
I wish I were that broke.
But yeah, no, it is a good point about that line, because it even helps the audience. Like, because we're waiting too. Like, oh man, he's going to find out. Oh, he just found out. What's going to happen? And it's a good line.
And the movie goes,
bigger than me and you.
Not yet.
Yeah, essentially not yet. And where I was okay with it.
It's Rhodey going like, next time, baby.
I don't know if that's bad. Yeah. But Raimi, I mean, it worked fine.
Raimi did a really good job in this film making sure that everything connected in an interesting way, right? So when Harry sends Doc Ock out to get Peter, he like hesitates, and then he leans over the building and he says, don't hurt him. Don't hurt Peter. And you realize in that moment, okay, he still is there, though. He still, you know, loves his friend. And it just adds that little bit of extra gravitas in that ending scene. You really believe that Harry's like, this can't be real. It can't be you.
Right.
Though there was a moment, like when he said, don't hurt Peter, I, in my head, had Doc Ock going, can't hear you.
La, 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 la.
Must have, because... Yeah, he throws a car at him, and then he throws him.
Sorry, climbing down a building.
La, 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 la. Jeez. But the end fight is really cool.
Yeah.
That, you know, when we get to the bay or, you know, whatever. And like you were talking about earlier with Doc, I love when Spider-Man takes off his mask to reveal that it's Peter, and Doc Ock's like, oh, shit, you know, and he gets through to him. And instead of Spider-Man talking to Doc Ock, it's Peter talking to Otto. And he connects with him, and it's like, you don't want to do this. This isn't you. Even though he's kind of a jerk throughout most of the movie anyway, and it kind of is, which I meant to talk about, but we kind of skipped over and I forgot. Like, he kind of has an attitude and an arrogance already, which kind of makes his transition into being a supervillain work better, honestly. Because he's not just this altruistic Captain America who turns into a psycho. He's kind of got an edge already. And he's kind of rude to Peter throughout the beginning of their interactions. And the tentacles just make it worse. But the fact that Peter's able to break through to him and be like, I kind of wish he would have said something to the effect of, your wife wouldn't have wanted this for you.
That's the thing. Okay, the alternate title of this episode is Joe Makes Stuff Up. Because I could have sworn that what actually shocks Doc Ock out of himself is that Peter says something about his wife. And I kept waiting for it. Because,
like I said last time, it's because that's what he should have said.
I mean, you're probably right. Because they set it up so beautifully that his wife, of course, is the one thing that he loves greater than himself, than his own ego, than anything that even his ego can produce. And so when you take that one thing away and there's nothing to replace it with, all he's left with is the ego and what the ego can produce. And that's what the arms play in on, is the idea of... Mm-hmm. Don't let him grieve. Don't let him think. Don't let him, certainly don't let him try to find something else that's more, that can be more beloved than his ego, than us, the arms. And so I kept waiting for that beautiful tie-in of Peter saying, you know, what was the wife's name again? Rosie. What would Rosie think? Or saying something about that. And then that would remind him, oh, yes, there is something greater than science. There's something greater than my ego, than what I can produce.
Because he legit says that in that dinner. Like, love is the most powerful, most important thing. I think, like I said at the beginning, this is the stepping stone to get from old garbage comic book movies to MCU Dark Knight Trilogy era comic book movies where you actually let the villains mean something. Like, this almost got there, but it's still that classic comic book Robin Banks to Build My Machine villain. They don't let him have that moment where he goes, oh, what I'm doing is wrong. Like, they kind of do, but they don't drive it home of bringing up the wife again, bringing up his, you know, his beliefs again. Like they could have, that like they would have if that movie was done today.
Yeah. Can I ask you this then? So, and this actually connects with Spider-Man 3. And granted, okay, it has been, I don't think I've seen that film since the movie theater. Yeah. Here's what I remember, and I could be wrong. I remember thinking, you know what? This film should have just been Sandman, and that's it. And just leave mm-hmm. it at that. Because there is at least one beautiful moment in that film where Sandman realizes that he's lost what was most beautiful about him, his connection with his child. Is his daughter? Is that it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. That, to me, was such a beautifully moving moment. And I think that that moment could have been good enough on its own if you just kept escalating what Sandman was doing. And the more he was pulling himself out, the more he was losing parts of him like grains of sand, just losing that. I thought that would have been enough for me, and it would have been, at the least, at its worst, it would have just been a good movie.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, they really could have done so much more if they had just taken a breath and set up Venom in three. Like, give him the black suit. You have to. You know, make him have that evil turn. You have to. And it would actually help with the Harry story, with the Sandman story. But then have Eddie get the suit at the very end, and then have it be the Venom show in four. But by doing everything all at once, none of it had time to breathe. So Harry gets dispatched in the first 10 minutes. Sandman's great in his openings, but then you don't care about him anymore, and then you have to care about Venom, even though Topher Grace was not that great. So yeah. It's just...
Yeah,
and, it's a lot of great ideas that didn't get to actually happen because they were cut off by each other.
Yeah, and I think the only reason why I was connecting that moment with this conversation is because it almost seemed like that was a beautiful transition into what you were talking about how you didn't get that level of a catharsis, of a beautiful moment mm-hmm. with Melina, with Doc Ock. It almost seems like maybe they had learned something, but they added so much to three. It just tried to do so much. It just went all over the place. If they had kept it right there, I think you would have seen just a beautiful connection to Doc Ock into Sandman. It would have been a different kind of character. You would have had a different kind of feeling because it wouldn't be romantic love then. It would be the love of a child. And that's a different kind of thing. That is a beautiful kind of step up, even.
Yeah. And it could have been done so well, because in three, Peter is wanting to settle down and marry MJ. And here you have Sandman, who has a wife, who we don't really see, and has a daughter, who we do see at least once. And you see what getting superpowers can do. If it corrupts you, like he was already a criminal, so I guess he didn't have a stable family, but he had a family, and then he gets these powers, and now he can never have that again. Like, yeah, we'll get to Spider-Man 3 when we get to Spider-Man 3, and you're certainly welcome back for that one, because I think we could have a lot of fun with it. But, Spider-Man 3 should have the subtitle Missed Opportunities.
Yeah.
So to get through the last of this real quick, MJ obviously discovers that Peter is Spider-Man in that final fight. We get the Goblin Cave, and then we get MJ running out on her wedding. And there's also been another fan theory in this movie that the guy she passes in the park, who has the dark hair and turns, is Thomas Jane, Punisher. And it does look like him. I don't know if it's ever been confirmed. But it sure looks like him.
I didn't notice it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when you see her running towards the camera and it's all super bright, glossy, there's a guy who's, you know, in kind of dark clothes and black hair, and you see him kind of look back at her and then keep walking, and it wouldn't surprise me, because these movies came out within a month of each other, or a couple months of each other. Right. April and June.
Yeah, right. 2004, right? For Punisher? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then Peter and MJ are finally together at the end. Happy ending.
It was, yeah. And I really liked the way that they heard the, I think it was that they heard the sirens or something, and she tells them, go get him, Tiger. Like, it was like she's okay with this, and she understands, and I know it's kind of iffy in three, but she understands that this is who he is, and yeah, go be the hero. Go be my hero. So I did like the way it ended. It was nice.
You know what I missed, though? I missed it, the first watching. I remembered her being like kind of super excited about the moment and very loving and supportive in that moment when he leaves. But her final facial expression actually looks somewhat worried. And
yeah, I always thought that too. Like, she almost looks sad.
Yeah, like, and that's something I never thought of before.
Like, oh, this is going to be my life. I even thought that as a kid. Like, yeah, you have this moment and you're finally together. And she's been harping on it the whole freaking movie. And just trying to get him to be like, yeah, I'm Spider-Man, but I love you, so let's figure it out. Which would have solved half this movie's problems, honestly. Yeah. But yeah, at the end, I've always, even as a kid, I was like, she looks almost sad.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't really put my finger on it, and I'm not going to try and, you know, put too much deeper meaning into it right now, but there is that kind of moment of like, maybe did I make the right choice?
Yeah.
Like, I had stable, boring-ass astronaut man, but at least he was there, and I've given all of that up for this guy who's going to have tentacle men and goblin gliders coming at him for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then he hits her in a club while he's going all emo and ruins it anyway, so it's fine.
And she goes back to trying to kiss guys upside down. That's it.
Yeah, just... which who doesn't? All right, some fun facts and Easter eggs, and we'll get Joe out of here.
Yeah.
Do you want to start, Jeremy?
Yeah, I can do that. So at around 24 minutes, when Peter flips over an oncoming car, Tobey Maguire performed the stunt himself. A stuntman also performed it, but Sam Raimi thought Maguire's looked more natural, so he used his instead. Nice.
At around 5 minutes, Stanley originally filmed the cameo of the man who exclaims, "Whoa, he stole that guy's pizza!" But because of problems with the shot, it was refilmed with Donald Rawlings, and Lee was given a different cameo playing a pedestrian who pulls a woman out of the way of falling debris during a battle between Spider-Man and Doc Ock.
I liked it.
Which is pretty much what he did in the first movie, too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that. At around 1 hour 50 minutes, the extreme close-up shot of Dr. Octopus sinking in the water is entirely digital. The SFX team hailed it as the most detailed rendition of a human face for its time that was purely done in CG. Wow.
And it's like Joe was saying, like, for the time, this is incredible CG. Like, I was thinking, watching the train sequence of, like, this was remarkable when it was done. There are scenes, you know, shots of digital Doc Ock that don't look great, but for the most part, this was huge for 2004.
Yeah.
According to Michael Chabon, is how I'm going to say that, early drafts of the script prior to his involvement featured Doc Ock, Black Cat, the Lizard, and Harry as the new Goblin. Sounds vaguely familiar. It was his suggestion to cut down the number of costume characters to just Doc Ock and Spider-Man.
Great.
Good call.
Yeah, good call.
If only he'd stayed on for the next one.
Yeah. All right, let's get into some Easter eggs. The hospital scene after Doc Ock's arms are fused to his body and surgeons attempt to remove them mirrors a similar scene in Ock's origin from Ultimate Spider-Man. The horror aspects and the chainsaw on surgeon tries using is similar to another Sam Raimi film, Evil Dead.
Hmm. Yep.
Ash very famously uses a chainsaw, for those who don't know.
Yeah.
Speaking of the surgery scene, one of the surgeons in the hospital scene is John Landis, director of Animal House, American Werewolf in London, and Blues Brothers, which I
really
did not know.
I didn't know
apparently.
That.
Yeah. That's cool. That's what IMDb said. So if I'm wrong, they're wrong. Get mad at them because I just copy and pasted.
The pizza place Peter works for is located on Bleecker Street, which is where Dr. Strange's Sanctorum, oh my gosh, that was my last try.
You can do it.
Is located.
That was good.
Strange also gets a name drop with when Jameson is trying to name Doc Ock. Yeah.
Oh, and I think I'm sure we said this in the first one, but his sidekick in that is Ted Raimi, Sam Raimi's brother.
Oh wow. Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the guy's the character in Spider-Man, but yeah, the guy with the glasses, the dweeby guy, that's mm-hmm. Ted Raimi, Sam Raimi's brother. Huh. The guy on the balcony who gets the slice of pizza taken back by Spider-Man before he can take a bite is Evil Dead 2 writer Scott Spiegel.
Okay, nice. My daughter loved that. She got a huge chuckle out of that. I loved it. Peter dumping his suit in the trash is a recreation of a scene from Amazing Spider-Man number 50 titled Spider-Man No More.
I put a future Easter egg on this because I just love the scene so much. The brilliant but lazy I'm trying to do better exchange between Peter and Otto is referenced in No Way Home when they come face to face at the end of the film, which I thought was fantastic and gave me goosebumps when I watched it.
I'm excited to notice that next time. I didn't notice it.
You don't remember? Yeah. Yeah, when after you know all the kerfuffle and everything's kind of settled down at the statue, and Peter is, you know, on that scaffolding with Doc Ock. Otto says something like "brilliant but lazy," and Peter says "trying to do better."
Huh. I love that. Gosh, that's so awesome. Good.
It's even better in the actual thing because they know all the words and I don't. But yeah, it's good stuff.
Well, my imagination made it very good. So there
good.
You go.
Good.
And before I read this last one, is it a? It must be a deleted scene for this movie where we get J. Jonas Jameson in the Spider-Man suit, like dancing around or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Really?
I thought it was actually in the movie, and so I was waiting for it. I was like, my daughter's going to love this. And it never came, and I was like, what the hell?
I like how both of you created completely different movies from what we actually got, but still enjoyed the experience.
I know. I kind of like my director's cut, too. I like my director's cut. Yeah. Wait, can
mine
I add
was
a-
at least on film.
Can I, that's a good point. Yes. There was something wrong with me making up the film. But I think this might be an Easter egg just for people who like this kind of stuff. I could swear that that's Phil Lamar, voice, you know, of, you know, DC animated films galore, but Jon Stewart, most notably. That looks like Phil Lamar in the train scene on the right-hand side of the screen.
Really?
Just another
I didn't pick
kind
up
of,
on that, but.
Yeah, just another connection to the superhero world. If somebody wants to take a look at it, it's the train scene when they pull Peter in. He's still at the front of the train. They just start to pull him in, like they all start, you know, closing in on him. Mm-hmm. I think that's Phil Lamar on the right hand side.
That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he is in random ass movies.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the guy in Pulp Fiction. Like,
good point.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, our final Easter egg. Tobey Maguire injured his back during the production of Seabiscuit, which almost caused him to drop out of the film. Future Mysterio Jake Gyllenhaal was set to replace him. Thankfully, he recovered, and the back injury was referenced multiple times in the film and in a future Easter egg in No Way Home.
That's right. All right, I think that does it for Spider-Man 2. Thank you very much yet again, Dr. Joe, for joining us on this. It is always a blast having you here.
Always a pleasure, guys. I love it.
And if you want to come back for Spider-Man 3, you're welcome.
You know. Yeah, I'll definitely reach out when we get closer. I don't know how far along it is now. I don't
and just throwing this out there. Yeah, we'll get there. Okay. And X3 will be out sooner than that. And even better train wreck.
Oh, I thought you guys liked me. What the heck? Jeez.
All right. I will leave you alone for that one, then.
It is fun to dump on movies, and yeah, those ones yeah. certainly deserve yes. it, because I am the juggernaut bitch. I mean, come on now. All right, that does it. Our rambling is through. Jeremy, what are we doing yes. next?
Next episode is going to be Blade Trinity. We're not sure if Woot. We have a guest or not, but hopefully we can get Brandon back. He was on for Blade 1 and 2. It will be interesting. I don't know. They seem to like when we are ragging on movies, so maybe this will be perfect for the listeners.
I've definitely got some things to say.
Perfect. But if you want to get a hold of us, let us know your thoughts on either this movie or Blade Trinity, reach out. You can go to the website, wearemarvelpod.com. You can email us, wearemarvelpod@gmail.com. Or find us on social media, wearemarvelpod on everything. And if you go to the website, you can click on our merchandise page and pick out a design you like, and then turn that into a shirt, a mug, stickers, whatever you want. But yeah, that's it for this week.
Alrighty.
Yeah. So until next week, thank you all for thank you all for listening. We appreciate you tuning in. And Joe, again, like Justin said, thanks for coming on. And until next time, I've been Jeremy.
And I've been Justin.
And I'm Joe.
Perfect. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.